Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk to the author of Dangerously Divided, How Race and Class Shape Winning and Losing in American Politics. The book is published this year by Cambridge University Press, and the author is Zoltan Hainal. Zoltan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
Yeah, such a pleasure. Very, very timely book about such an important topic. Before we get started, as we do on the podcast, maybe you can just introduce yourself just a little bit, where you've been, where you are now. Share with us who you are.
Sure. So Zoltan Hainal, I'm a professor of political science and public policy. I'm here at the University of California, San Diego. And, you know, what I really am about is sort of trying to understand American democracy and the role that race plays in that democracy and use that understanding to try to sort of reduce some of the imbalances that we might or might not see in that democracy and to make it essentially fairer and more equitable.
Yeah, this book is so multifaceted and takes on so many, I think, assumptions that people make about politics and challenge those in such a rigorous way. And you do so in such a novel way as well. And maybe we can just start there. That you start your book by explaining that your book is centrally focused on what happens after voting, on what you call the outcomes of democracy. Why is this focus different from how other scholars have approached this terrain, and why did you think it was an important way to approach the subject matter?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's different. It's not certainly absolutely unique, but for the most part, a lot of political science is about the inputs of democracy, right? So who votes, who do they vote for, and on a lot, and the institutions that lead to those votes or non-voting. And that's incredibly important, and we want to understand that, but for a lot of us, and I think for those who think more deeply about it, what we ultimately care about are the outputs of democracy, right? So once that vote is counted, who wins and who loses? And then once people enter into office, what are the actions that they undertake? Who are the big policy winners? Who are the big policy losers? And then even more deeply, how does all this affect the actual well-being of individuals in society? And so I think sort of the importance of that is obvious. What's been difficult often in the past is getting measurements of some of these things. So getting measurements of who's represented, whose policy views are represented has been difficult. And so, you know, modern social science, modern data has allowed me to do a little bit more of that.
Your book is also focused centrally on the importance of race. It's in the title. Now, others have made the case that it's class and not race in American politics that explains the political divisions and outcomes that are of such interest. I wonder if you could recount, you know, maybe, so what is the central argument for class? And also what the central argument for why race should not matter or does not matter. And then we'll get to more of your thesis in the book.
Sure. Yeah. And There's every reason to expect class to be central in American politics, especially today. So America has, you know, for the last half century been unequal. We have had a class divide, and that income inequality, wealth inequality has just grown massively over time. We all know that that's occurring. And so the life chances, the life perspective, the circumstances of those near the top is radically different from those of the average American or those near the bottom. And so we're living these radically different worlds. Class matters more and more in terms of individual well-being. And so you would think that should filter into our politics, and that there should be an increasing divide between those who are well off economically and those who are less well off. And so that all makes sense. The reason to expect that to matter and race not to matter is that in many ways we have overcome some of our racial difficulties. We've passed a range of laws in the civil rights era that essentially have created legal equality. And we have all these signs that race seems to matter less. Younger Americans seem to care less about race. They've grown up in a much more diverse setting. You've seen America elect its first African-American president and then reelect that president. There are a wide number of indications that race may be declining in importance in society in general and in American politics in particular. So there's a lot of reason to believe that it is class and not race.
Now, when you refer to race, and you make this clear in the book, but maybe you can just sort of briefly summarize what you mean by race. What do you mean by race? How do you measure it, generally speaking? What does it mean? What are the races that are central to what you're interested in the book?
Sure. And race is, of course, this socially constructed, horribly problematic entity that, people don't necessarily fit into. And we can think about race in all sorts of problematic ways. But here in the book, the notion is pretty simple. I'm looking at how people self-identify, and I'm looking at the largest racial and ethnic groups in American society. So largely looking at preferences of whites and contrasting them or comparing them to the preferences of racial and ethnic minorities, in particular African-Americans, Latinos, and Asian-Americans. And those are the central categories in the book.
Now, the book has, in very simple terms, a lot of bad news, but maybe we could start with a little bit of the good news from the book. In terms of racial representation in office, you write that substantial gains for almost every racial group, that there have been substantial gains for almost every racial group in elected office, the national, the state, and the local levels of government. What do you make of the data on those winning office and whether it tells a story of progress or of something else?
Sure. And there has undeniably been progress across the longer arc of American history, and in particular in terms of racial and ethnic minority representation or descriptive representation in office. The number of Blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans in office has gone from essentially close to zero in the 1960s to the tens of thousands in total today. And we see those gains at every level of office, as I mentioned, Barack Obama at the presidential level, but everything from the local level, city councils, mayors, to the state and Congress as well. So those gains are real, and they've been felt by racial and ethnic minorities. They have created a lot of joy, and they've created a lot of change. We have other political science research showing that sort of descriptive representation can make a difference. On the other hand, the reality is despite all that growth, racial and ethnic minorities remain sort of greatly underrepresented at every level of office. And so, whites who represent roughly 2/3 of the population represent closer to 90% of those in office, at almost every level. There is certainly some variation, but we are still, the leaders of this country don't look much like the population that's voting for them.
Now, from a distance, what I think a casual observer might say is, you know, there's too many other things getting in the way to draw the conclusion that race is very important, the most important, an important factor, and things like one's ideology or political views or even one's party affiliations are going to determine much more about one's outcomes. This gets to how you did some of your measurement in the data that you looked at. Before we get to your findings, would you just describe a little bit about where you turn for evidence and maybe what sort of is novel about how you approach these data?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, the data aren't actually novel, and then I'm looking at major national surveys for the most part, or census data, so sort of standard data sets. What I think is a bit novel is one, the breadth of the data that I'm looking at, so long time spans of in terms of voting patterns, long time spans in terms of policy output. So we're talking 4 or 5 decades, and then you know, the ability to make broader statements about who is in fact winning and who's losing, and sort of, I think thirdly, a lot of the data that I have allows me to make explicit comparisons between race and class and religion and age and gender, and as you say, ideology and partisanship. All those things matter, and they help predict who wins and who loses. But when they're sort of essentially put up against each other, there are factors that matter more and factors that matter less.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Some of the conclusions that you are able to support in this book, some of the findings are just staggering. And I just wanted to sort of very briefly read sort of a statement that you make and then give you the chance to kind of explain how you got to this conclusion, because you obviously mean what you say. And so you write in the book, even after considering political views and party ID, African-American voters are substantially more likely than whites to be on the losing side of democracy for every type of election. This is a big, powerful statement. How did you get to that point? What are the key pieces that allow you to draw that conclusion?
Sure. And it's actually relatively simple process, although it did take a lot of data behind it. But so in that part of the book, what I'm looking at is the question of, so when you voted, did you end up voting for the winner in that candidate? So the candidate that you voted for, did they become the incumbent, the leader, or did you vote for the loser? So it's very simple. Is your vote a winning vote or a losing vote? And then the more complex process is adding all that up for every individual and every survey. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of people, and then looking at that across literally hundreds or thousands of elections, looking at it at every level from the presidential all the way down to the local level, city council, mayoral elections. And then for each election that you voted in, looking to see, you know, which demographic factors or political factors are predicting whether you won or lost. And what we see is, and here's another sort of bright spot, I think, for American democracy, is that for the most part, there aren't big demographic differences in terms of winners and losers. So men across this long arc of time and across the wide array of elections win at roughly the same rate as women. You see similar rates of winning and losing by class, by religion, and even to a certain extent by party and ideology. And so, you know, there's a fair degree of equality in terms of the outcome of the vote. Beyond that, there is this racial distinction. So African-Americans more than any other group end up losers, and they end up losers consistently across every type of election. And so you typically have a gap of, you know, blacks losing 5, 6, 7% more than whites on average. And that gap doesn't go away. That racial gap doesn't go away when you control for all the factors that we think matter. Again, age, gender, religion, party ID, ideology, and so on and so forth. So you have this sort of unexplained racial gap in terms of who's winning and who's losing the vote. And it's real, and it's, you know, substantively reasonably large. And so it is for that in that sense, somewhat troubling.
This would be less troubling if in spite of not winning in the electoral sense, eventually the policy benefits kind of accrued to everyone in some sort of either random or equal way. But that's not what you find here. And it's what you were describing at the start of our conversation. You write in the book, race has the largest single effect on who government responds to. Race is twice as powerful as income or education in explaining who wins in the policy arena. This is an even a more damning statement about democracy. And maybe you can tell us sort of how you figured this out, because this is even a step sort of more complicated, but more telling about the sort of state of the democracy.
Sure. Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I think what we care about who gets elected, but even more so, we should care about what they do in office and who they're responding to. And so this is a really important part of what I'm trying to do here. And so the notion here is to look at the responsiveness of government to individual preferences. And how I get at that is I'm looking at national policy, and I've got about, again, a 50-year time span or 40-year time span of public opinion polling, in this case, through the General Social Survey, which asked what you want your money spent on. So, for example, do you want more money spent on welfare? Do you want more money spent on the military or less, or kept it at about the same rate? So we have an array of individual preferences, and we've got the race and ethnicity and gender and so on of each of those individuals. And then that's matched up with what the government actually did. So after you are asked about the survey, we then look at spending in the next year and look to see whether spending mirrors what you want or doesn't mirror what you want. So if an individual survey respondent in 1976 said, I'd like more military spending, we then look in 1977, the next year, to see whether there is, in fact, greater emphasis, more spending on the military or not. And we then do that for, again, about 500,000 respondents over a 40-year time span. And when you add up all those individual preferences and all those government policy outcomes, you find that, again, race more than any other factor predicts whose preferences are met. And you have a similarly large, about 5, 6, 7 point racial gap in responsiveness.
Now, there are dozens of other findings that are equally powerful and equally worrisome. But I wonder if we could sort of take a step back and just look at the title of the book, Dangerously Divided. You have demonstrated in the book the divided part. But what's the dangerously part? What's dangerous to you about these empirical findings that suggest race is so important in deciding these kinds of different outcomes? Why are we dangerously divided?
Sure. And you know, first of all, division is a part of democracy, and so that's fine. And then there are also going to be winners and losers in democracy, and that's also fine. The concern and the danger is if the losers, if there's one group that's being singled out and is consistently losing, right? So I just mentioned that there's this, you know, 5+ point gap in racial, in responsiveness to different racial groups on policy. But what we see is that gap exists for every policy area in almost every year of the past 50 years. So there's a group that's not only losing on the vote consistently, but losing on policy consistently as well. And the fear is that that's going to lead to anger and resentment that bubbles over beyond the electoral arena. And I think there's evidence that that is, in fact, occurring essentially on both sides. With the election of Barack Obama, you see an increase in racial hate crimes. Again, with the election of Donald Trump, you see a further escalation in racial hate crimes. And you see that, you know, reasonable political division can turn into a more troublesome, more dangerous, more violent relationship relatively quickly. And so that's part of the concern. Part of the other part of the concern is, you know, the groups that are losing the most are in some ways the groups that need the most help. So African Americans as a whole fall well behind whites in terms of well-being, and yet there our democracy is serving them less. So both of those things are in some sense dangerous.
Yeah, the really, really fascinating book again is titled Dangerously Divided: How Race and Class Shape Winning and Losing in American Politics. The book is published by Cambridge University Press, and the author who you've been hearing from is Zoltan Hainal. Zoltan, thank you very much for your time today.
It was a pleasure to be here.